session number 27226, reel 11.
On hook reel 11.
Right. Well, by the way, I forgot to talk about the safety pilot, and I didn't understand what it was. But it's a measure of recollection that, in fact, I act as a safety pilot for my instructor, and I sat in the back and flew the aircraft from the back while he did whatever he wanted to do in the front, and I probably flew it from the back as well, acting in his capacity. Merely an exercise, but very useful, obviously, because if there might have been circumstances why I needed to fly in the back of the aircraft as well, but it was just a check. So really we're now in the situation where navigation and testing and going from A to B were the primary thing. There was no real problem about flying because there were, between a normal short flip, things that you could identify with, and of course map reading was part and parcel of the ground exercises anyway, so you could always get an idea. Trouble is that sometimes there's a lot of it's the same, but you've got to remember that if you're moving forward, you've moved from one place to another, so it must be the next one, which gives me to a story when I come to Kenya, which I must remember to tell you. But that's, by the way, that's navigation, following lines, following railway lines, following points, following objects. And if you know that your course is that way and there's an object that's right in front of you and you're not going to change that, you fly on that. And that is your ground track rather than your course, which is what you've been making normally if you were flying properly.
So is there anything else about the course that was different from your elementary flying training?
Well, yes, we're in Canada. So we had social life as well. We had dances on the course. We had girlfriends. Though we had girlfriends, but we didn't see as much of them, I don't think, really. We lived a normal life. We flew during the day. We did our work. We had night flying, of course, which was which came in this part of the course, up to the tail end of the course. But we weren't night flying. We could go ashore into Kingston, which was a drive down the road. We all had our own mobility. I had a hutmobile, which we fed on sump drainings, and we scrounged petrol. It had a vacuum pump, which shows a little about engines, a vacuum pump for petrol, and the seals had gone on it. So we had to stop and fill it with petrol, so petrol with a carburetor. And during that time, we went to Wiener Roast, so we had picnics in the country with the locals, of course. We had barn dances, which was a good... and that was maybe in the second part of the course, but we can deal with that. We went to a place called Inverary, and we had two girlfriends with this hutmobile, and it was 20 miles away, down the bottom of a slope, across the railway line, up the hill, and onto Inverary. And we took these girls in this hutmobile, and we had a barn dance in a barn, a Canadian barn, where the floor was made with maple, Canadian maple. And we'd always danced in the Spa Royal Hall on a maple floor. It was unbelievable to think it's Royal Hall in Britain with a maple floor, and this one was every bit as good. They even had a concrete section on the top of this floor where they had a fire to toast things and eat and everything else, and dancing in the top and everything else. And this went on till about midnight. My particular girlfriend was the daughter of the governor of Kingston Penitentiary, which you may have heard of, read in the book. But penitentiary was the real hardcore place of Canada for prisoners. And I rather fancied this girl. She was rather nice. I had one whose father was a penitentiary wizard, the governor, and also one who had a farmer on rural route number 2. And I never went out there, but during that course, which, as aside from learning to fly, was the social aspects, which I'll deal with later, we went on this barn dance with Charlie Williams, who was he was from Mauritius, he was a Frenchman. He got me into more trouble than you've had hot dinners. We went with this whole hutmobile, 26 miles, to a barn dance at Inverary with my girlfriend, who was rather nice, and Charlie's girlfriend, who I cannot remember. A good time. Come back. The car ran out of water. We had no water. We got some water from the barn, of course, but then we had 20 miles to go, and this thing was bloody leaking, wasn't it? We managed to scrounge a can of some sort of kind, and we managed to get to a windmill pump, where there was water. It's in the middle of summer, so there's not a lot of water around anyway. Fill this. And this top vacuum filler for petrol kept running out, and we had to suck the petrol from the tank into a can, pour it into the vacuum filler, run another 5 miles or so or whatever, and stopped. This is at 12 o'clock to about 6 o'clock in the morning to get home. These girls were not really part of this at all. They just went to sleep in the back seat, and Charlie and I had to keep this bloody machine, this thing going. And we went all the way back, with stops on the way for finding water and filling it with petrol. It was not a very pleasant trip, I'll tell you. But we're on the way back, and we went down the hill to the railway line at the bottom. And we ran out of petrol going down the hill. So we're stuck at the bottom, about 4 o'clock in the morning. Outside would be about, 4 or 5 miles outside Kingston. With no water, no petrol. Stuck on the railway line. So we had to wake up the girls, get them out. And we got out of the car and pushed the car out of the way onto a piece of flat land. Let the girls go back in until we could find ways of being stuck in this bloody thing again. Well, time was going away very fast. We got it going and drove into Kingston to outside the Kingston Penitentiary to take my girlfriend back. The other girl lived near the airfield, and she was dropped off on the way to the airfield from Kingston. I don't remember much about it. But we got to Kingston Penitentiary very early in the morning, and we're outside the penitentiary, and there was a doorway into the main part of the place with a yellow bulb over the door, and this girl got out of the place very afraid of what was going to happen when he got back to her dad. And the last I ever saw of that girl was going in her dance dress through that door with a light shining over the top of it. I never saw her again from that day to this. But I did go back to Kingston many years afterwards to find out what had happened to her, and she died. But the bulb, which I told the blokes about, was still the one there that they were still there, never been used in all that time. And by that time, Kingston Penitentiary was a museum. And they remembered the daughter, and she died a few years before. It was a few years. I mean, I was well into my getting gone a bit. And she died. So I never followed that one up at all. But there are other aspects of this with the social life, which I'll come back to and deal with, if you like, as one entity, because Kingston was a very interesting place for an Englishman in Canada in a new environment, completely and utterly.
We'll deal with it now.
When we were there, we had, obviously, we were part and parcel of the community of Kingston, which was, 5 or 10 miles away, down a road alongside the lake. And while we were there, until the time we left, the lake was water. By the time we left, it froze over, and we had to get into Kingston driving our Hupmobile on the ice, which in itself was an experience. But Kingston itself was a friendly place with a town with shops where we could go. We met people from Kingston. The girls came out and we had dances and everything else. We picked the pick of the crop prop. And we met them from time to time. But mainly, you think that we either met them in Kingston or out on the airfield when they came out to social activities. We had the car, which is the Hupmobile, which I've already mentioned to you, which we paid £5 for from the previous course. And on our course was a bloke called Hammy Gray, who was a Canadian, with his best pal, who I was with later on, and who was killed later on, in Scotland at Arbroath. Hammy Gray was a first-class pilot on the 23 pilots course, which was the course before me. I was on 24th, and we followed our life followed through all the way. Hammy got a VC at the end of the war for sinking a Japanese destroyer with a Corsair, and he got a VC for it. But his pal was one he'd been school with together, and they had their own car, which was a T model Ford with no tyres on it because they couldn't get tyres for it, that used to run all the way into Kingston down the road, run round Kingston in this T model Ford, which they sold later on to somebody else, and it was still going on. It was the object was to get rid of the car, what you could get for it, to somebody else on the thing. But you can imagine a T-model Ford with two sailors up, running with no tyres on the wheels, into Kingston and around Kingston while we were there. And they were with us, of course. They were Hammy and his mate, I can't remember his name, but it's somewhere in my logbook, were in during the whole of the bombing at Kingston, St. Vincent. And they were in 23 pilots course, and they were all with the bombing and kicking of the incendiary bombs off the roof and going down to the oil fuel depot and everything else, which I haven't dealt with, because that was a major part of our existence, St. Vincent, really. Could go back to it. But
well, tell the story about what happened at Vincent, because obviously we didn't cover the incendiaries being kicked off the roof. So if you want to tell me that story about what happened with the incendiaries.
What, in St. Vincent? Mm. Well, we were always being bombed all the time we were there. And we either had firefighting duties either at the fuel depot and food depot in town in Gosport, or we had roof duty with a gun for aircraft flying over, and also for getting incendiaries out of the way if any dropped on the roof. And I can always remember both Hammy and his pal on the roof, and we were up there as well. I think I was probably on the gun pod at the time, but incendiaries are falling down like snow in summer, really, and they were up on the top where these incendiaries had gone off, kicking them down to the boys down below, who again kicked them further on to get them out of the way, so they burnt themselves out. So that was always a thing that we did there, and that's one thing I remember Hammy Gray for. But we were always together right the way through Canada, and our wheels crossed quite regularly from then on to the end of the war.
He was Canadian, wasn't he?
He was Canadian, was Hammy, yes. Oh, grand lad. He was a very good pilot, an excellent pilot, and he was selected. But he got onto Corsairs. He must have gone to Yeovilton. He went to Yeovilton. That is part of this aspect, because I missed my first course in Yeovilton, which probably saved my life in the end, and I missed a course. But they went to Yeovilton. They must have gone to Yeovilton, because they can't have gone to America to learn to fly Corsairs. But I'll deal with that one later on, if you like. It's verbose. But I, when I came back, it's after this, it'll come up again.
Yeah. How did you get on while you were in Kingston with the Canadians generally?
Oh, superb. There was no question at all. They thought the sun shined out of our bottom. In fact, I got, when I was there, the jeweller, I wanted a watch, and he sold me a Pierce chronometer for a fiver, which must have been worth much, much more than that, which I wore for years on the outside of my glove, and it fell off in Scotland. And he virtually gave it to me for next to nothing, you know. We came up against strange things. When we wanted to have a haircut, went to barber, and that cost a dollar. And a dollar was a lot of money in those days, where it used to cost tuppence on board ship. You know, the difference in money and the way it was spent. And we also came up against Chinese food, and we couldn't understand how people could just eat sort of fried rice by itself. And it was, that was in itself a transition. But we learnt about Canada, Canadian people. They were kind to us. They were,
did they ask you about conditions in Britain? Did they ask you about conditions in Britain and that sort of thing?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't remember, honestly. They probably did. Though I don't recall going to many houses in Kingston at all. Our social life evolved around the girls who came out to the camp and the social life and activity there. I've no recall, really. If we went into Kingston, we'd go around and have a look at the Kingston Military Academy, because it was the place to go. But recall of Kingston in itself, we went to a sports day in Kingston where there were people, but mine is very, very glossy there at all. It's probably due to the fact that we were concentrating on flying. It's interesting to think why. Because we'd obviously had a social life, and I could remember it in different constitutions, but probably here the stress level, which didn't bother us as a level, but it meant that we concentrated on the flying that we were doing rather than the social activities, because we knew that if we didn't do well on this, we didn't really have a career in the services, which we expected to have. I mean, the war was going to go on for a while, and you didn't expect to be an ordinary seaman or a leading airman for long. You wanted a commission, you wanted to fly, you wanted to be up where the hard action was. And in doing that, you were concentrating more, possibly, on the mental and physical requirements of what happened at Kingston. In an aircraft that was very much like the ones you were going to fly, and required more of a concerted effort mentally against a background of good food, good conditions, a more relaxed atmosphere with no bloody bombs. But bear in mind that up to the time we left Manchester or Winslow, we're still being bombed wherever we were. We travel by train. The train would be stopped because somebody dropped a bomb on the railway, someone on the line, or decanted. And there, if you went anywhere, you didn't go 15 standing one on top of each other's feet. You went comfortably. It was a comfortable life.
Did that help or hinder your training, do you think?
No, because it helped us, because we were relaxed. We could go out and do things. And strangely enough, you must have been physically strong, because you were burning the candle at both ends, quite frankly. But you didn't worry about it. It never left you at all. There were times when you were very, very tired, very tired physically. And you went to sleep, period. But that was part and parcel of flying and growing up, and the fact that, I mean, Kingston was, not Kingston, Eildon was a classic example. But the first month of flying at Kingston, you were knackered. You were fizzy, mentally tired, and it was very, very wearing. You really were tired.
Because you did mention earlier that you did some night flying at Kingston as well, didn't you?
At Kingston, yes.
Yes.
Oh, Kingston. Well, that was just a stage along from the course.
Can you explain to me about night flying and how you were introduced to night flying?
Yeah, well, we introduced to night flying at take my time. That came. That's the next second half of the course. Now, during this course, early on, and let me have a look. Just be with me. This gap was, to some extent, the part of the first course, which set us up for being familiar with the aircraft and doing everything we needed to do in the second part, which was flying aircraft, flying at night all the time, gunnery, aerobatics, fighter exercises generally. In other words, a transition from civil, in inverted commas, flying to actually using a fighting machine as you expect it to use it later on. It was if he wants it, but you were flying the aircraft in an entirely different way the second time round. Now, the reason I stop here and think a little bit, because my career, as I mentioned about tonsillitis, was not affected by this course, but halfway through the second of the month after I'd been flying, and I was just trying to find it in the logbook, I got tonsillitis. And the net result was that I was ill for 10 days. And I think you'll see, when we look at the whole history later on, when I got into Zymotics, when I got tonsillitis, I was poorly. It meant I was down. And I lost about a fortnight. I was just trying to find in my logbook, take a stop there. It looks very much as that I started flying again for the second half of the total course on the 9th of October. And as one would normally do in a course like that, you'd fly every day to get assimilated and do whatever you had to do. Presumably the weather was all right, it was October. And I see that I flew from the 9th until the 12th fairly solidly until the 12th, when I was doing night flying and I did a series of landings. About the 12th, quite obviously, oh no, 12th is 12th. At about this time, I got tonsillitis. And I was off flying for quite some time, 22nd. Having a quick look at my logbook, to summarise, I was taken ill with tonsillitis and I was laid off for quite a while. I think I got tonsillitis about the 3rd of November when I was still flying, and I was doing quarter attacks and targets and everything else, and RT, we had radios by the way, RT, radio telephony started in that course, but by the 6th or 7th I was ill. And I was whipped off with tonsillitis. And the net result is I stopped the course. I didn't get back onto flying until the 15th of November. So I lost nearly a fortnight of the course.
How did that affect you? Because obviously coming off the course halfway through...
That's the point I'm trying to make. That, in fact, I had the tonsillitis, and I had to recover from it. I was, maybe flying a little bit, but then I was out, and I had to stop. The net result was that I effectively lost about a fortnight or more of flying, and I had still... Um, quite a bit of the course to do, and I started flying all day and every day and doing nothing else, and I completed the course flying something like 4 hours a day, I think I was doing, 20th, 21st. I was doing flying all the time.
So they didn't put you back as such, they just allowed
I just did more flying. Where other people weren't flying, I was flying.
You mentioned in there a number of things, though, that you were learning at that second half of the course that we've not mentioned before, i.e. the night flying.
The transition to night flying, yeah.
And the air gunnery and that sort of thing.
Right.
Can you take me through those? Because
yes.
Obviously those things we've not discussed before.
That's right. Do that.
Do you want to start with night flying and just give me a rough idea of what you had to do with night flying?
Well, night flying is interesting because, first of all, before you went night flying, you were told you're going to go night flying, and you went and flew in the dusk, and you flew up to dusk until it got dark, and then you flew night flying. Now, when that happened, we'll have a look, see, force landing, air nav, night flying, 5 landings, with the instructor on the 2nd of October, night flying. And that was the first one. No, it wasn't. Oh, yes, it was. I'm going down. Right, that was the first one, night flying. I went up with my instructor for an hour, did 5 landings. Now, we started off before it got really dark and did those 5 landings in the dark. And that was really the break for the courses, because we now start night flying, where I did 5 landings on that first night, under instruction, in the front seat, with Harvards, straight night flying round the airfield, find the airfield, circuits and landings, which went on.
Do you rely on instrumentation for that while you're circuiting then? Is that how you work at night? Is it purely instrument?
You've been doing visual on the night flying landings, but you might do on the downwind leg, for instance, you might put your own instruments and do, or you might even take off, and when you're at a right reasonable level, do turns under the hood on instruments only, in the particular place where you'd normally turn, and the instructor find you going downwind and say, okay, come out from your instruments, now look where you are, do a night landing. So you had to do a night landing visually, you didn't on instruments, and that was part of the progression from flying at night to flying in the dark and landing in the dark. In other words, progression.
What could you see visually on the ground to kind of...
Well, in Canada it was lit up, of course. We had runway lights. I don't know whether they were paraffin, they must have been ordinary landing lights, but it was quite dark on the runway, and you could see the runway quite clearly. You knew where it was. Whether it was electric or not, I don't know, but when you're above it and flying into it, you knew what you were doing. You were flying onto an airfield that had a landing strip that was marked out by lights, and you came down, you watched what your height was, because I'm sure of that. But then you could get some indication in the right height at the right place to come in to do a straightforward landing. What it was, I don't know, but we'll say it was 250 feet. And you then could see the runway, and you came down to 100 feet and 50 feet, visually watching where you were, until you got nearer the runway, until you could sort of adjust to the lights and the fact that you were coming in there, and you were watching because you knew you were getting the airfield. It was running closer at 50 miles an hour, and you did a normal landing, normal as it could be, but you were using lights as an indication of where the airfield was, rather than there was the airfield proper. And of course you flew over the top of it to very close to landing as you wanted to, and then it didn't matter because you've closed your throttle, kept stalling speed so that you were close to the ground, and then you landed.